You don't put those inside of you, do you?
This is a show about women.
I mean, you do?
Yes.
Finally, a show about women that isn't just a thinly veiled aspirational nightmare. It's not hosted, not narrated. We're just dropping into a woman's world.
I found out when my dad was gay when I was 10. We were in a convertible on the 405 freeway, listening to the B-52s. Looking back, I should have said, this is gay. This is already all gay.
Listen to Finally a Show on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Ruthie's Table 4 in partnership with Montclair. Imagine going to a close friend's birthday months after the death of your son. Imagine realizing it was too soon and telling the man you're talking to, who you hardly know, why you need to leave. He takes your arm and he insists on seeing you to the lift. Then he goes down with you until you get to the street. This becomes a 10-minute walk to the car park, a climb up the stairs, him holding your hand tightly, until you find your car. Driving off, you see him in the rearview mirror, waving goodbye. I was this woman, and Tom Hollander was this man. And his act of tenderness and compassion has stayed with me for 13 years. There are many stories about Tom Hollander. The best ones are told by him, not least his life in the day for the Sunday Times, the best in a great series ever written. He is a fantastic actor. White Lotus, Patriots, most recently captivating audiences as Truman Capote. In Feud, Capote versus the Swans. He sings beautiful songs to his 6-month-old son. He's passionate about what he cooks and what he eats. Yesterday, he sent me a photograph with no caption of Fran Hickman with a large stainless steel saucepan obscuring her face, drinking the contents. Imagine being me in the River Cafe with Tom Hollander on a Tuesday afternoon, talking about memories of food, memories of friendship, family, and all he is doing. Then imagine how special this feels. And it's true. I remember that. And it is something that stayed with me for years. But what is really staying with me is spaghetti with peas and prosciutto.
So, ingredients. 100 grams of butter. 1 small red onion, chopped. 300 grams of peas. Sea salt and ground pepper. 1 clove of garlic, thinly sliced. 2 tablespoons of chopped flat-leaf parsley, 3 tablespoons extra virgin olive oil, 150 grams prosciutto slices torn into pieces, 300 grams of spaghetti, 50 grams of freshly grated parmesan. Heat the butter in a heavy frying pan over a medium heat. Add the onion and fry until soft. Add the peas and salt and pepper. Reduce the heat to low and cook for 5 minutes. So that's the thing about peas. I'm never quite sure. Mostly, we cook frozen peas, don't we? And you can pretty much just sort of put them in water for about a minute and then they're ready. But these peas, fresh, so you cook for longer. That's why they take 5 minutes of cooking.
Yeah. It depends really what part of the season you're in. When you have the very, very small peas, you hardly have to cook them at all.
I see.
And then, you know, the tougher they get and the larger they get, you might not use them in a pasta sauce because you want them to be cooked down and really part of the softness of the pasta.
But so these were new season, fresh peas.
Yeah.
So you've added the peas and the salt and the pepper and you reduce the heat to low and you cook it for 5 minutes. And then you add the garlic, parsley, prosciutto and olive oil. You cover and cook over a low heat for 15 minutes. Meanwhile, bring a large saucepan of salted water to the boil. Add the spaghetti and cook until al dente. Add the spaghetti to the pea mixture. Stir well with a spoon. Stir in the pasta water and top with Parmesan cheese. Serve immediately.
So you've just made this in the River Cafe.
Well, I just watched
Joseph. What was
Joseph
that like? Yeah.
I watched Joseph. It was thrilling because I haven't ever seen somebody who knows really what they're doing that close up. It was also delicious and made me want to go and cook it.
It's good to watch, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's good to actually see something being made rather than always reading in a book.
And to see his hands move.
Yeah.
Someone who's done it for years, so it becomes like a dance.
Have you ever cooked on stage?
I don't... Oh, I feel like I did. When I was a child actor, we did sausages. We had sausages in a...
What was the play?
It was called Captain Styrick, and it was one of the greatest shows that the Children's Music Theatre, which is, I think, now called the National Youth Music Theatre, National Youth Music Theatre, created. It was a brilliant, dark ballad opera, it was called, and we were all ragged children, Dickensian beggar children in Bartholomew Fair. And there was us, and Captain Styrick was the young, it was the young kid who was our leader. There was, it wasn't Fagin, like, it wasn't Oliver Twist, it was actually darker. And Captain Styrick went mad. Julian Sylvester, he was called. If you're out there, Julian Sylvester, you were unforgettable. Anyway.
Maybe he's listening. Yeah.
Maybe he is. I hope he is somewhere. And we...
How old were you, Tom?
Oh, 13, 14. Mm-hmm. And we did it on the stage of the National Theatre in what was then called the Cottesloe Theatre. And we had sausages, which we cooked on a... I don't think we really cooked them, but we were as if cooking them, and then we got to eat them. And, you know, it was quite fun to have something to eat halfway through the second half. I remember that. Yeah. I sing the song from that.
What was it?
I sing that to Kit, our son. I sing it to him. Now many a man has left this land on a boat that's bound for Botany. Why should he grieve? He could be leaving a life of mere monotony. He'll boast and brag of the deed he's done to avoid the nag of the hungry sun. But he's been undone at the feast of fun, and it's Botany Bay for him, sir.
Do you, when you are on stage, does your schedule for eating change?
I try to eat in the day before. The biggest meals in the afternoon before the show, because it's quite athletic.
So what time would that be if the play starts at 7:30?
Then 3 or 4.
Yeah, you have
three
a
or
meal.
2 or 3 or 4, and then go to sleep, yeah, and then do the show. And then if there are people in, then you find out you're going out to dinner, then you have to have fish and vegetables and try not to eat all the chips and all the rest of it.
And matinees?
Matinees... the last play, I would have a falafel salad in the dressing room without leaving between shows, because that you just need carbohydrate and fuel and then go to sleep, and you try to eat a biggish breakfast on a matinee day. But that in-between show day, I would buy it before, I'd take it in, put it in my fridge, eat it, go to sleep. That was a ritual that was very good.
Yeah. Would you drink? Would you have alcohol if you were going on stage?
Between shows?
Yeah.
No.
Never.
No. Yeah. Though everyone... No, I tried to. I tried all of those things in my 20s, and it's a mess. Yeah. It affects your timing and your memory and your speed and your reactivity. You can't. It ruins it. But in the olden days, I remember Oliver Cotton telling me that it was very strange, in the mid-80s at the National, everyone stopped drinking during the show. he said if you were on stage with Paul Scofield and you were downstage center, you would expect to smell whiskey on his breath.
Wow.
So they were just used to it. I think it didn't. They would drank so much more in those days that it just didn't affect them in the same way.
Mm.
But obviously, alcohol, a small amount of alcohol or a small amount of any intoxicant, releases your imaginative stuff and makes you relax.
Mm.
When I played the violin at school, I would always find concerts very tense making, and I discovered that having half a glass of beer allowed me to play better in a concert situation, just because I was so racked with nerves otherwise. But the association between, you know, being artistically brilliant and being intoxicated has got an awful lot of people into terrible trouble over the years, not least of whom Truman Capote.
We could talk about Capote and women and food, because those women, there are a lot of so many scenes in restaurants, right?
That's
they went
true.
To lunch every day.
You're right.
But I wonder if they ever
How much
ate,
they
because
ate.
Being skinny was the
Was their
goal,
job.
Right?
Yeah. They drank, I think. They drank and smoked.
They did.
They drank and smoked and sort of died young. Yeah. Perhaps they were celebrating being in the in crowd and being at the table, the best table in the best restaurant. And yes, they were restraining themselves. He couldn't stop. He couldn't control his appetite. And he loved cooking. He loved.
Did?
He loved his own kitchen. Yeah.
He's from the South. Was he from the South?
Yes, yes. Yeah. And the black and white ball they served his, you know, the black and white ball, yeah. The sort of apotheosis
moment. Maybe you should
moment.
Tell people what
the black and white ball was. A ball that Truman Capote threw in, I can't remember when, the very early 60s. Yeah. On the back of In Cold Blood, which had made him hugely famous, and his obsession with sort of high society and his own celebrity came together in one glorious moment. And he created the guest list to beat all guest lists that have ever existed, so much so that people knew about him, were fighting to get on it. And aristocrats flew from Europe, all the film stars, you know, Frank Sinatra, Mia Farrow, the Agnellis, probably Mick Jagger, we can ask him. Mm. They all turned up to the plaza and he gave them corned beef hash, which he remembered fondly from Monroeville, Alabama, where he'd grown up. But they all complained about the budget of the catering, that it was very small. For him, it was about getting them in. They were the decoration. Yeah. They were the party. Their dresses, their masks. But there was nothing there. There were some balloons and some rather stodgy food that none of them wanted. And I think the party ended relatively early and a whole bunch of them went gambling.
What was it like filming that scene? Was it
amazing?
Did you do it at the plaza?
They recreated it in the plaza.
Oh, they recreated
yeah, they
the
did.
Plaza.
Yeah. Yeah. And Zach Posen had done the dresses for the ladies. It was amazing. That was, and there's a sequence in it. If people, he did it emotionally for his mother, we think those of us who made that show, because his mother wanted to, Truman's mother, who'd abandoned him when he was four, then married a man called Joe Capote, who gave him his name, Truman his name, but who was he was dodgy, his finances were dodgy, and she nearly made it herself into Upper East Side society, and then Joe Capote was revealed as being sort of bankrupt and hopeless, it all fell apart, and she killed herself. And then Truman had this ball to go, look, Mum, I've done it. I've done it for us. Everyone wants to be here. Mm. They've all got to be here. And in our version of it, episode 3 of Feud, Capote and the Women, in our version of it, his mother comes to him as a ghost in the ball. And what Lee Radswell sees is Truman dancing drunkenly on his own. And Lee Radswell looks across the room, Callista Flockhart, looking at him sadly, going, look at the poor sod. He's just a drunk. And then the final scene of the episode is in colour, and he's not dancing on his own, he's dancing with his mum.
Did he eat?
He did.
And
he
have
loved
addictions?
Cooking.
Yeah,
he was addictive and compulsive. So he goes up and down. You see, we, in our version, we pretty much do Fat Truman because I couldn't, in a TV schedule, go up and down as much as I needed to. So we went with Fat. Ryan Murphy said, you need to put on some weight. So I did, which was very enjoyable.
How did you do it?
Obviously, less enjoyable trying to lose it again.
How do you gain weight?
I've done this a couple of times. I did it. You have to just eat all the things, the obvious things like pizza and ice cream and Cornish pasties and chips, and then you get fat very quickly.
How does it make you feel?
And then it's marvelous in the moment, and I started to find it hard to put my socks on, and I got breathless doing sensible things. Ordinary things. That was distressing. So, and also I'm a bit old to be messing around with my weight like that. And furthermore, I have a little bit of a compulsion to overeat myself and have spent most of my professional life slightly going slightly up in between jobs and then having a diet before a job and going up and going down and going up and going down and trying to stay disciplined. Trying to be like my father, who weighs himself every day and And if he ever goes over 11 stone, he has a light breakfast. He says, I know whether I can have a heavy or a light breakfast, depending on what the scales have told me. Every day he does that, which sounds like, you know, one of the swans with its level of obsession. But he's 88 and still going strong.
You were saying before that putting it on was one thing, but you haven't told us about how you take it off.
So I went to a clinic.
Oh, you did?
About half of it came off in an Austrian clinic. And then I really only lost. And then I went and did the play in which I was playing someone who needed to actually be a bit heavier than me. So I,
that
it took
was,
me.
That was
Patriots. Yeah. Playing Berezovsky, who was quite portly. So I kept it on for that. And that worked. And then I only got it off about 3 months ago with the fear of doing the American press junket. That motivated me enough to cut down on everything for a few weeks, and it came off. And so I'm always trying to you know, discipline myself. But I do have a tendency to, I love eating, but I also eat my feelings, you know.
Yeah.
Which people do, and if you do it too much, it's not good for you. So I try to do other things with my feelings.
The friend of mine, I was at a dinner recently where they were talking about Ozempic, that drug.
Oh yes, yes.
And they were saying that, and it was kind of interesting to her. She said, "Really, what it's done for me, it's taken the noise of food away. It's taken all that noise. Should I? Shouldn't I?
Yes.
Will I? Won't I? How much? When?"
Yes.
And actually, I understand that a lot. But I also think it's a kind of noise we do want in our life as well. We like the noise of food, don't we? We like the kind of thought of going to bed at night and thinking, what am I going to have tomorrow for lunch? Or
And actually, it's the noise of being alive, isn't it? It's the desire, then the fulfillment of the desire, the creative process, the gathering of ingredients, the construction, the destruction, the kind of the clearing up afterwards, everything from the preparation to the end of it. I could become pretentious if
I'd say,
but you know, it's a cycle of life, isn't it? But to be at war with food, which you can be, is not good. And I do have a sense of that, because being, you know, an actor where you become inevitably obsessed with your appearance, you know, it has a tendency to make you think, well, I mustn't eat, I mustn't eat, I mustn't eat. So I'm beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. It's never really made any difference. I met an actor once in Italy who'd long retired. He'd been a famous 60s heartthrob, quite famous. I'm not going to name him, partly because it would be the wrong thing to do, and also because I can't remember his name. But he said, I had to retire because I was sick of being thin, and I wanted to eat. And he lived in the Italian hills near Cortona, and he loved food, and he ate it. And he's probably no longer with us, but he was living the life of a, you know, a bon viveur. And I did sometimes think, I'll get to a certain age and then I'll give up trying to not be fat, and then I'll just become a fat actor, because fat actors, they never stop working. There's always room for a fat actor in everything. Anyway, I can't do that.
Orson Welles, right?
Well,
Orson
exactly.
Welles.
Orson
just
Welles
think
or,
of Orson
or the
Welles
dear or, Richard Griffiths, or, you know, you sort of think they're loved, but I don't want to do that, because I now need to live as long as I can.
For sure, we certainly shall, because you have a son.
I do.
Did you know the River Cafe has a shop? It's full of our favorite foods and designs. We have cookbooks, linen napkins, kitchenware, tote bags with our signatures, glasses from Venice, chocolates from Turin. You can find us right next door to the River Cafe in London, or online at shoptherivercafe.co.uk.
Hey, my name's Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. I just had a great conversation with Michael B. Jordan, and you can listen to it right now. Michael is known for his performances in both film and television. His breakout role was in Fruitvale Station, playing Oscar Grant, which earned him widespread praise and numerous award nominations. His portrayal of Killmonger in Marvel's Black Panther, one of my favorites, further solidified his status as one of Hollywood's leading actors, earning him widespread acclaim for his complex and compelling performance. In our conversation, Michael really opens up. You're going to love listening to it, and I can't wait for you to check it out.
The closest to getting what you want is always the hardest. It's always the feeling when you're getting ready to, you know, people give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get. People quit.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
What were meals like in your house? Did you all sit down for dinner every night?
Yes.
Did your sister, you and your sister?
Yeah, it was
your
the
parents,
four of us.
Your mom cooked.
And mom would cook. And
did your father cook as well?
Dad didn't cook then, but he did. He didn't cook when we were children, really. But he learned to cook once we left home, and he loves cooking now. That's one thing that's maybe that's changed. I wonder whether this was true. I was thinking about it. Just that when I grew up, it felt like, you know, mothers did the cooking, yeah. Fathers did the eating, but that we've lived through a period where that's changed, right?
Mothers are working.
Mothers are working, so fathers are cooking, and then people like Jamie Oliver, scion of the River Cafe, have taught everyone how they can do it too, right? So, but I have image of my father learning to cook, and then I am sort of learning to cook actually at the same sort of age, which is great. That's a great development, isn't it?
Yes. When you were growing up in your parents' house, your grandparents were nearby? Were they?
They were in Devon, no. We were in Oxford, but we used to go to them on the way to Cornwall every spring and every summer, and sometimes on the way back. And then towards the end of my grandparents' life, he was living with us in Oxford.
Your grandfather, who came from Germany with your father? Czechoslovakia.
Yeah, in 1939 he came with my dad, yeah.
Mm. How old was your father?
Three.
Oh, I see, so your father came very early.
Yeah.
So yes. The grandmother, grandfather, and your father.
1939, yeah. They made this epic journey across Central Europe and landed at Harwich, I think. Yeah, and they had sort of 25 suitcases at the beginning of the journey, and they were thrown off one by one, reduced to about three by the time they got to the end. And the only money they had left was in my father's shoe, the toddler's shoe. And then they knew some people. My grandfather ran a radio station in Czechoslovakia. The music was in charge of the music, the classical music part of it, and a BBC producer had sent him this letter inviting him to come to give a talk about Janáček, because my father knew Janáček and had written about Janáček and promoted Janáček and was a friend of his. And please bring us some expertise about Janáček. And that was what allowed them to get through, because they had German accents, so people were suspicious of them.
Did they speak English at all?
My grandmother spoke quite good English. And my grandfather had to learn English, but they were, you know, he was 42 or something. Mm. 40. He was born in 1899. So, yeah, they.
And this is your grandparents. Did they cook for you?
They did a bit. I think my parents used to take over pretty much doing all the domestic things when they got there. We used to say it was bohemian, their life on. It was technically Moravian. Happy food situations were in our home. I have very happy memories of our family suppers, in which the day would be downloaded and we'd all share our experience of school. My parents were teachers, so we would all be talking about what had happened at school. Mm. They would be as well. And I did miss that. That's one of the principal memories of growing up, is that moment of the day, for sure.
So let's look at this book.
So this is a book that my mother made me when I was a student and sent me off to be a student with and put in a few of the favourite things that we'd eaten that she'd cooked us. And it was to sort of start us off. So
this is when you went to Cambridge, wasn't
it? Yeah. So 1985, she would have made this for when
I was... So we're looking at a book.
So she's written Bon Appetit, and then she's sectioned it into soup, fish, meat, miscellaneous. Yeah. Under miscellaneous is tomato chutney.
And your mother grew up in Britain, did she?
Yeah, yeah. Yes, she grew up in Africa until she was six, and then she was in England. But Tiroler Kreuzel. Sort of thing that we used to eat as children.
So she learned.
Well, it's Central European. It's Tyrol. Yeah. It's Tyrolean, actually. It's Czech Austrian because they were. So we did eat. And Dad, what's fascinating about, because Dad does not really. Dad is an Englishman now, but when we go, it's food. Food reveals about your origin. So he loves Wiener Schnitzel and he loves. Apfelstrudel, which he now makes.
He makes Apfelstrudel. That's intense.
He makes very good Apfelstrudel. And so Mum used to cook things. Oh, goulash we used to eat regularly, which I've recently learned how to make, which is I'm thrilled about because it's...
What meat do you use?
Actually mushrooms the last time, no meat, a vegetarian goulash because Fran is vegetarian. And then I secretly sometimes make it, if Fran's not at home, I made it with venison. We live in a bit of the country which is infested with deer, and people are always giving each other piles of venison out of the deep freeze. So delicious.
Cool.
But Tiroler Kreuzel is... Tiroler Kreuzel is a sort of... is a kind of peasant alpine dish.
Simple. Oh, cooked potatoes.
It's potato and garlic sausage.
You have the cooked potatoes, and then you're adding salami, ham, and sausage.
Those are sort of ores, either, but garlic sausage is the classic thing. Yeah.
And then you add the garlic, then the potatoes fry, add the meat to the ingredients, and cook for another 10 minutes. That seems like a good recipe for a college student, doesn't it?
Yes. And then it was a bad recipe for an out-of-work... young actor who didn't have enough to do and would go, well, I can fill the second half of the day with lunch and the consequences of lunch. I can fill it with the buying of the ingredients, the cooking of lunch, the overeating, and then the falling asleep. And that'll get me to PM program. That would get me to 5 o'clock. No, but I remember making Tiroler Kreuzel in Peckham in 1989.
This is beautiful. If you like listening to Ruthie's Table 4, would you please make sure to rate and review the podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.
Hey, my name's Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. I just had a great conversation with Michael B. Jordan, and you can listen to it right now. Michael is known for his performances in both film and television. His breakout role was in Fruitvale Station, playing Oscar Grant, which earned him widespread praise and numerous award nominations. His portrayal of Killmonger in Marvel's Black Panther, one of my favorites, further solidified his status as one of Hollywood's leading actors, earning him widespread acclaim for his complex and compelling performance. In our conversation, Michael really opens up. You're going to love listening to it, and I can't wait for you to check it out.
The closest to getting what you want is always the hardest. It's always the feeling when you're getting ready to, people give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get. People quit.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there. I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to the one and only Ryan Seacrest.
Love the connection to people. I think at the core, what I get excited about, what gets me up in the morning, is connecting with people in an unscripted, unvarnished way. Is getting to say something to them, hear back from them, know that I'm part of the routine, and I look forward to getting on the air. I look forward to it.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
You were doing theater ever since you were in the play in the National Youth Theater. And you auditioned for this from the Dragon School? Is that when
It was at the next school. It was called Abingdon School. And, yeah, this company used to go around schools and work in the school with the drama department for a term and create a show and then take it to the Edinburgh Festival. And we were all incredibly lucky. And from that, I got... They did one called... Well, Captain Styrick was the first one, which I think they'd started at Haberdasher's Asks. It all sounds very embarrassingly privileged, which it was, because they were all, I think, independent schools. Tiffin's it started at, which is, I think, a sort of grammar school at that point. But it was actually that National Youth Music Theatre thing that I got picked up for a TV film, a BBC Dickensian drama for children's theatre in 1981 called John Diamond, which was an adaptation of a Leon Garfield book. And that was so exciting to be picked up. I had a term off school. I was driven around in a car and I got given money and got to stay in a hotel on my own and eat. I remember eating duck à la ronge on my own at age 14 in the hotel in Tetbury. and thinking, wow, this is the life. And that rather rewired my brain in a way that... is either helpful or unhelpful, because it meant sort of the end of ambition, or at least it meant the end of imagination. So I then thought, well, I must repeat this for the rest of my life and become an actor. So though that was when I was 14, and then I went back to school, went to university, and then, yes, was always waiting to start acting. Anyway.
This is a report recently. Have you seen that the percentage of actors who've been to private schools?
Is getting bigger and
bigger.
Yeah,
I think maybe. And so maybe this will change with our new government, but the investment in state schools to culture, well, we could get political, but it is true it is part of education and part of the priority of a society to find the kids who want to act.
Well, because we won't have all the 60s heroes. All those actors, the Albert Finneys and
Michael Caine.
Yeah, they were all the Terence Stamps and the Peter O'Toole's. They weren't privately educated.
But Michael Caine said that he was not allowed. It was a real triumph when he was able to play a military man with a Cockney accent, because apparently that was not done.
I see.
Yeah.
But that was, of course, exactly.
I think that's another theme that has gone through. You know, we talk about grandmother's cooking, but we also talk with people, particularly in the arts. They see being able to eat the food that they want, drink the wine that they would like to have, as a measure of their success. You know, discovering that food, what food could be.
Yes.
You know, did you have that, or did you?
No, I did.
And when was that? That you describing having duck in a hotel.
Well, that was
when
I was 14.
That
was a feast.
Of all the memories you have,
course.
You're choosing the eating one.
You're right. I did. I repeatedly did it. The 20 or 30 years it came to a head when my accountant said when I went for that meeting that you have with your accountant at the end of the year, where they tally everything up. He said, "You realize you eat every single night in a restaurant." And I said, "Do I? I'm sure that can't be true." And he went, "No, you do pretty much 5 out of 7. I mean, you know you're doing that, do you?" And I went, "No. But I think I was definitely experiencing that thing of going, I can celebrate the fact that at least it's working out sufficiently to allow me to do this. And yes, regularly celebrating the fact that it's okay by ordering something slightly more than you ought to.
Is that where you spent? He's noticed that. Did he also say you've bought too many clothes or you've got too many taxis?
It was food. It was that. It's restaurants. Yeah.
We did that when Richard and I lived in Paris. It was when the days when you had checkbooks and checkbook stubs.
Yes.
And, you know, we used to go through it. You flick through it, and every stub was the name of a restaurant or a food shop. It went to the food,
Well, at this moment, in this conversation, it feels like a wonderful thing to have done.
Yeah.
I sometimes think, ooh, ouch, maybe I could have just... Now I'm in a phase, now we're in this sort of, the world has changed, and that's not the way I live anymore. And also now, we have a child, and so the family dinner thing is suddenly becoming exciting, you know, and so that little vignette that we were just talking about, the family supper, that's suddenly becoming the kitchen table, the home-cooked food thing, that's all suddenly becoming the new aspiration. Mm. Also, the world has changed, and so swanning about, jumping out of cars, going into flashy restaurants doesn't feel quite right anymore. But I'm looking forward to, cooking our child fish fingers and peas.
Yeah.
That joy and ketchup. I'm looking forward to all of that.
Food is about your father and your grandfather coming from Czechoslovakia. Food is about sitting at the table and your mother's book that, you know, this beautiful book that your mother gave you as a gift to tell you what to cook and what to eat. It's almost like she was coming with you. It also is comfort. So to finish what has been a glorious imagined day, I would ask you, Tom Hollander, to tell me if you need comfort, if you have to go to food for comfort, is there a food that you would choose?
Well, it's in a sort of Desert Island Dissy way, if I had to reduce it, if I was allowed the one food to comfort me, I would take my grandmother's chutney recipe.
Do you want to read it?
Sure. 3 pounds of tomatoes, 1 pound of onions, half a pint of vinegar, malt, very important. I tried to make it with refined malt vinegar the other day, didn't work. 1 tablespoonful of curry powder, 1 tablespoonful of dry mustard, 1.5 tablespoonfuls of corn flour, 1 pound of sugar, 7 dried chilies, but chilies you can put far more in. Some people like it very hot, some people don't. 1/4 teaspoon of cayenne pepper, salt, 2 tablespoonfuls of salt. And you cut up the tomatoes and the onions and you sprinkle them with salt and you leave them overnight. That's the long bit. And you let them do some chemical thing. And it smells very strong the next morning, that mixture. And then you pour in the vinegar and you add the sugar and the chilies and the cayenne. You boil for 1/2 hour. You mix the curry powder, the mustard and the corn flour. And you get a paste and a little vinegar. You add it to the rest slowly and you stir it in bit by bit. Boil for 5 minutes, stirring all the time. And then you put it into bottles and seal. And you take the chilies out before bottling if you don't want it too hot. And it's absolutely the most delicious chutney I've ever had. And you can, you know, have it with cheese, obviously. You can also stir it into risotto. You could probably put a blob on, you can put it on anything. Mm. I love it.
Well, would you bring me one next time?
I will. I will. I should have done that.
I'd love to try it. No,
I will. I'll bring you.
I'd love to try it. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Beautiful time.
Thanks, you.
Thank you.
How many a man has left this land on a boat that's bound for Botany? Why should he grieve? He could be leaving a life of mere monotony.
Thank you for listening to Ruthie's Table 4 in partnership with Montclair.
Ruthie's Table 4 is produced by Atomai Studios for iHeartRadio. It's hosted by Ruthie Rogers and it's produced by Willa Malensky. This episode was edited by Julia Johnson and mixed by Nigel Appleton. Our executive producers are Faye Stewart and Zad Rogers. Our production manager is Caitlin Paramore and our production coordinator is Bella Cellini. Thank you to everyone at the River Cafe for your help in making this episode.
You don't put those inside of you, do you?
This is a show about women.
I mean, you do?
Yes.
Finally, a show about women that isn't just a thinly veiled aspirational nightmare. It's not hosted, not narrated. We're just dropping into a woman's world.
I found out when my dad was gay when I was 10. We were in a convertible on the 405 freeway. listening to the B-52s. Looking back, I should have said, this is gay. This is already all gay.
Listen to Finally a Show on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like $1 million.
...scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes...
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old rich man, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart for a year, and what a year it has been. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Make Woke AF Daily your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.